So there's a psychologist named Roy Baumeister, and he says that as people wrestle with the meaning in their own lives, they tend to really kind of wrestle with it and struggle with four underlying questions and ideas. And the first has to do with identity. Who am I? Right? Like who am I really? Second has to do with value. Do I matter? In this big world, you know, there's so many people, do I matter? The third has to do with purpose. Why am I here? Right? What's my purpose on the planet? And the fourth that we're going to zero in on today is agency, meaning can I make a difference? And this might be one of those things that we kind of think in our mind on a cognitive level that, oh yeah, I can make a difference, but you know, deep in the recesses of our hearts and those secret places that we don't always tell other people what's going on in there, we really kind of wonder, and part of the reason we wonder is because we live in this big, massive media entertainment culture. We see smiling people on magazines. We hear about people in history books and all these big examples of this. We wonder, what about me? What about a normal person like me and you? We're not going to be remembered in history books. Like, what about us? Fred Craddock tells a story about when he was young and he was in a church service and he was sitting in one of the front pews and just tiny, had a Sunday best on, his kind of feet were dangling, you know, they weren't long enough to hit the floor. And he's listening to this speaker talking about what it means to live as a Christian. And, you know, he's trumping out these examples. This is really what it's like. And he talks about Mother Teresa, you know, serving in the slums of Calcutta. It talks about, you know, Dr. Albert Schweitzer, and he's a medical missionary, and he puts on, you know, these piano concerts, and he's playing Bach, and he's raising money for these hospitals in Africa, or Martin Luther King Jr., and he's, you know, changing things in the civil rights movement. It's amazing. And Fred Craddock is sitting there as a little boy. He's wondering, it's too bad that just a normal person like me can't be a Christian. Because some of the examples of love and sacrifice and what it means can sometimes seem so grand, it makes us question ourselves. And so this message today is specifically focused on those of us who kind of wonder sometimes, can I really make a difference? And we're going to frame that question a little bit differently through the lens of John chapter 6 in a way that maybe some of us haven't thought of before, but in a way that I think is very, very encouraging. And so we're going to open our Bibles to John chapter 6, and this is a part of our walk through the Gospel of John. We're just going verse by verse. Okay, we're just going through slowly. We're looking at the details. Details matter. So just as a recollection about the context, starting at chapter 5, really the hostility and opposition towards Jesus really started ramping up. Last time, you know, Jesus had healed this man at the Pool of Bethesda. He had done so on the day of rest. The religious leadership had accused him of making himself equal with God, and so Jesus has been defending himself, speaking about the unity he has with his heavenly Father. And today we come to chapter 6. Now, it's really interesting. This is actually the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. And this is the only miracle other than the resurrection that is preserved in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So it's interesting because of that. But also, we need to keep in mind that it's part of a longer narrative. So we're only going to look at the first 15 verses today, but it really goes to the end of chapter 6. And Jesus is feeding them in part with bread, and later in chapter 6, he will talk about himself being the bread of life. So there's obviously a thematic connection, but we're going to talk about that more specifically when we get there in a couple of weeks. Okay, chapter 6, verse 1, I'm reading from the ESV translation of the Bible. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Okay, Sea of Galilee, it's called a sea. It's really a lake, like a freshwater lake, 20 kilometers long, about 12 kilometers wide. It's north of Jerusalem. A lot of fishing activity going on there. Even today, there's a lot of fishing going on. Along the north shore, there's a town called Capernaum, which is like Jesus' home base. So this is kind of home territory for them. And a large crowd was following him because they saw signs that he was doing on the sick. So people are starting to flock to Jesus like flies to honey. And he's teaching things with authority, and he's casting out the demonic. He's freeing people from deception. And at the same time, he is healing the sick, right? The Pool of Bethesda, the man 38 years heals him. And when we go through the stories, we can kind of take the power of these things for granted. We read the stories. We've read them multiple times, many of us. Imagine the sick people in your life, physically sick, mental, emotional challenges, whatever they happen. Think of people you care about, you love. And there's this person named Jesus who can say a word or put his hand on them, and they're healed. No wonder he's becoming popular. We would flock to him as well. Verse 3, Jesus went up on the mountain. So this is the east of the Sea of Galilee, what we today call the Golan Heights. And there he sat down with his disciples. Now, the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. So this is verse 4. So recall that Passover is that annual celebration commemorating of God liberating the Hebrews from slavery in Egypt. So think April-ish. That's kind of the time of year. Verse 5, lifting up his eyes then and seeing what a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. So Jesus asked this question of Philip not because he doesn't know. He's doing it to test him. Interesting, as you go through the Gospels and as you learn more about the different apostles, you know, Philip, we learn from, is the nearby town of Bethsaida, which is like only about nine miles away. So if anybody was local who knew where you'd be able to find like large quantities of food in short measure, it would be Philip. But so yeah, I think that heightens the tension of what's going on here. He tests him, verse 7. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. Okay, so we don't use that currency anymore. So this is roughly 8 months' wages for a general laborer. In the ancient world, I did the calculation based on what's going on in Canada today. So it's like he said, $25,000 worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. Verse 8, one of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Okay, we'll come back to that detail about the boy later. Verse 10, Jesus said, "Have the people sit down," which is an indication that he's going to do something. Have the people sit down. Now, there is much grass in the place. Pause. Just an interesting little side note. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I went over specifically a lot of the reasons why we know that, you know, the Gospels are trustworthy testimony. John himself is an eyewitness. As you go through the Gospel, you see a bunch of details that he includes in the story that are totally superfluous to the story. They have no function in the story, like that there's a lot of grass there. That's one of those details. But John includes them, like, why? Because he was there. He's just recalling what happened when he was there because he saw it. Okay, there's grass in the place. So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. So it only names the men in this story. Why? Perhaps because he's counting in shorthand, using men as heads of families. Perhaps that's the case. I did say that this story was also recounted in the other Gospels. So in Matthew's version, Matthew 14, 21, indicates that in addition to the 5,000, there are women and children. So this is a large amount of people. We might assume like 20,000 people. So that's like, imagine all the people jammed into a professional NHL hockey arena. Like, that's how many people are here. Verse 11, Jesus then took the loaves, which would have been more like a pita loaf. It's not like kind of the Wonder Bread slice things that you get in Zares or No Frills today. He takes the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. So here's the miracle. And also just want to point out this word, give thanks. It's really the Greek word, eucharisteo, eucharisteo. So that's where we get the word, one of the places we get the word Eucharist. So, you know, he's doing something. This sounds like communion. He's taking the bread, he's giving thanks, he's distributing it. And then he gives well, and they have as much as they wanted. Now, this is the miracle. This is where it happens. Jesus is proving himself as not only a great teacher, but as a wonder worker. And he's performing a miracle. And this is a lot of food. Okay, so it's not like there was one piece of bread that was cut up in little tiny fragments and they each got a little bit. It reminds me of a Far Side comic. Remember the Far Side comics by Larson, you know, like the single panels? I tried to find it this week. I couldn't find it, but I remember seeing one at one time, and it was about this, and there's a couple sitting in church, and it's communion, and they've been given these little tiny squares of bread, right? Little tiny squares, and the one guy whispers to the other person beside him, presumably his wife, and says, "No wonder he could feed so many people." Right, it's so tiny. But of course, the point of the story, as it says here, there's more and there's more, and it keeps multiplying over and over. Mark Batterson has a friend, Joel, who works at a church in South Africa, and he was feeling particularly low. He worked in youth ministry, particularly low, and so one night, he's going to McDonald's, and he's not feeling great about things, and he's got enough money for a Happy Meal. So he's going in, but as he's going in, he gets this prompt from God that he should do something else with it because in the parking lot, there's five street kids. And he's like, okay, well, I really want this Happy Meal, but here's God giving me this prompt to buy some burgers for these kids, these street kids. And, you know, you're wise to not, you know, ignore a prompt from God. So he goes in there and he buys five junior cheeseburgers. But by the time he gets outside, the number of kids has doubled. So instead of there being five street kids, there's now 10. And as he walks over there, he's like, what do I do? Do I just give it to half of them or do I cut them in half or whatever? Anyway, he opens, you know, the bag and starts handing out these junior cheeseburgers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and they all get one. And all 11, there's one for him. And as he reflects on it, he's like, what in the world just happened? Is it possible that I just paid for five junior cheeseburgers and McDonald's made a mistake and gave me 11? Or did God show up to feed some street kids? And the point is that multiplication happens, and in this story, and this is the miracle. So it's not like some sort of, you know, sleight of hand is occurring. Food has been miraculously multiplied. Verse 12, and when they had eaten their fill. So it's like, they have to like, it's not just they're having a little bit. It's not like Uncle Bob comes over for Thanksgiving dinner. You know, everyone's got to have a bit less ham just so Uncle Bob can be accommodated. No, everyone has had their fill. And so they have to loosen their belt buckles. Loosen the ropes on the ropes. Whatever the ancient equivalent is of that, right? They've had their fill. He told the disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. There's leftovers. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the five barley loaves left by those who had eaten. Now, 12, it's very specific, right? 12 baskets. Well, historically, that's what happened. There might be something that God has worked here on a symbolic level as well. So in the Old Testament, there's 12 tribes of Israel under God. In the New Testament, there's 12 apostles of Jesus under our sovereign and monarch, King Jesus. And so is this maybe one of those cases where something has happened physically, also communicates something to us symbolically that Jesus can in fact provide for the entirety of God's people? It's hard to know. It's not spelled out in the text. That could be happening. Verse 14, when the people saw the sign that had been done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who has come into the world. And so they are indeed flabbergasted. They are drop-jawed at what they have seen and experienced. Yeah, no kidding. And then they say, maybe this is the prophet who is coming into the world. And so, right, there's this religious fervor, expectancy of a Messiah. This is probably a reference to a prophecy back in Deuteronomy 18:15, right, where this prophet will be raised up and people are to listen to him, perhaps. Verse 15, perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Now, why would they take him by king? Well, recall that they had been awaiting a Messiah. And many people were awaiting a Messiah, and that's a Hebrew word that means anointed one, referring to God's chosen king and representative on the earth. And a lot of people were awaiting a political Messiah who would overthrow the dreaded Romans, and so come not with nail marks in his hands, but with a sword in his hands, right? And so Jesus, perceiving that they've, you know, what's in their hearts, and they're going to come and kind of make him king and put him on their shoulders metaphorically and kind of rush to, you know, fight against the Roman overlords. Who knows? He wants to deflate that situation and thinking. His kingdom, as he will later say, is not of this world. And so he withdraws to the mountain. And so we end the text there. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
All right, so what do we focus on in this story? I'd like to focus in on a very important detail, and it's the boy. Okay. So remember how I said that this is the only miracle recorded in all four of the Gospels outside of the resurrection. And so I'll tell the story. Only John includes a detail about a boy. Now, we're not told what his name was, so he's anonymous. So he is the source of these five barley loaves and of these two fish. Okay, so we know that they came from a boy. Now, what else do we know about him? Well, we know that the amount is most likely the amount for one family meal. So it's not a lot. Okay, now it's interesting. There's different kinds of bread in the ancient world. Barley bread was not considered a good kind of bread. It was considered the normal bread for poor people and slaves. Okay? This is an interesting one of those details. Poor people and slaves. It was less nutritious, and therefore it was less expensive. The word for fish here refers to smaller type of fish, perhaps dried, perhaps pickled, we're not sure. But from this we can deduce that here's this boy who has come Where's his parents? We don't know. Remember that in the ancient world, so many people died before the age of 30, so maybe his parents are dead. Maybe they're around, and he's just acting by himself. Maybe older siblings or an aunt and uncle are taking care of him. We simply don't know. But they're clearly, maybe they're poor. Maybe they're hard off. Maybe it's a slave family. We simply don't know. But they have this one meal's worth of food, and at some point, he has to make a choice. Do we keep this for ourselves? This is probably the only meal that they will have all day. Or do we hand it over to Jesus to see what he can do with it? And at some point, clearly, he says yes. And he hands it over to Jesus or to Jesus through the apostles. So it's an act of faith. He's going to take what meager gift he has. And we as readers are supposed to see this contrast. You know, over time, we've maybe lost sight of some of the customs, and so we don't see the contrast as much, which is why I want to highlight it to us. A small, meager meal of a poor family or a group of people contrasted with thousands of hungry people flocking to Jesus. And so at one point, he makes a choice. I need to trust that Jesus can do more with this bread and fish than I can. And all of a sudden, and we don't even know his name. Now, Mark Batterson has a great way of saying it. He says it like this. Next slide. When you add God to the equation, his output always exceeds your input. Say that with me. When you add God to the equation, his output always exceeds your input. And I think the reason this is a good detail to focus on today is because maybe there's some people here or watching at home or listening later that need that reminder. Because we wonder about the kind of difference we can make in the world. And because we're not these impressive people, we're not someone who others are going to notice, we're not going to be in a history book, we question whether or not the difference we can make is something that matters at all. And stories like this specifically remind us that they do. It's not about appearing in a history book. It is taking what meager offerings we happen to have and trusting Jesus with them, knowing as an act of faith that he can do more with them than any of us can. And so what is it? What is that offering that we think is meager, that we think is little, that we need to hand over to Jesus? Because let me tell you, God does not waste what is given to him in faith. Is it some volunteering that you're a part of? This could never make a difference. Is it some money? Is it some sort of relationship that you're working on? Maybe it's something in the home. Maybe it's something else at work. Maybe it's something that you're dedicating some time to and you're wondering to yourself, who am I? Like, what difference does this make? When you add God to the equation, his output always exceeds your input. He never wastes what is given to him in faith. And so our job is to think, what are the kinds of things that I'm doing that I can give over to him that I need to entrust to him, and he will use beyond my wildest imagination, right? And a lot of us, the things that we're working at, we're not even going to see the fruits of those things in our lifetime, but that's okay, because God's got it. He's working on a longer time horizon than we are. Example, Paul Tudor Jones was a man who has left an incredible legacy on the world. Okay, great heart for other people, different initiatives. He started the Robin Hood Foundation, so some of you would have heard of the Robin Hood Foundation. He has a particular heart for helping underprivileged children, inner city schools, and over time, the Robin Hood Foundation has invested $1.45 billion in benevolent and philanthropic causes. I don't even know how to conceptualize $1.45 billion. People wondering, well, how did he get his start? What happened? Well, he tells us. He writes a story about being 4 years old, and he was separated from his mother while in an outdoor vegetable market. And this is what he writes. When you're 4 years old, your mother is everything. And this extraordinarily kind, very old, very tall black man came over and said, don't worry, we're going to find your mama. Don't cry. We're going to find her. You're going to be happy in a minute. You never forget stuff like that, he wrote. God's every action, those little actions, become so much bigger, and then they become multiplicative, meaning they multiply. We forget how important the smallest action can be. For me, I think it kind of spawned a lifetime of trying to always repay that kindness. What's that stranger's name? End quote. I don't know. Jones doesn't know. He's long dead. But a part of that man's legacy, and of this there can be no doubt, a part of that man's legacy, that anonymous man, anonymous just like the boy from John 6, is the Robin Hood Foundation and $1.45 billion of philanthropic and benevolent donations. Wow. And so here's what I want to encourage you to do. This week, just take some time in prayer and your regular devotional time and just think through those things that you are somehow contributing to. And you just got to be honest, because there's things that we're all involved in various ways, at work, at home, in a relationship, volunteering, financially, resources, time, energy, all the things. Think about what's something, and you're not sure if it makes a difference. And what I want you to do in prayer is dedicate that to God and ask God, "Dear God, I commit this to you for your glory and for the advancement of your loving purposes in the world. I commit this to you for your glory and your loving purposes in the world." Just yesterday, I was doing some yard work, and as you know, we moved out to Shaney Bay, and the former owner of the house came by, Mary Kay, and we were talking about this beautiful lilac tree right beside the front driveway. And she told, because she remembers when it was planted, and we were just enjoying it, so one of the like deep purple, you know, those really deep purple ones. And she told me the story about it. She said, "Oh, for a long time, we were going to give up on that." And I said, "Oh, what do you mean?" She said, "Well, we planted it, and it's like, no lilac first year, second year, third year, no blooms fourth year, fifth year, sixth year, seventh year, eighth year, ninth year, 10th year, 11th year, 12th year. I asked my husband, Paul, to come over with the tractor. We put a chain around it. We were going to tear it out." And just as he's revving up the tractor, she's like, "Hold on." She walks over, and she starts to see one little bloom on that tree. And now it's got these incredible blooms. If you ever go there, you can stick your head in the driveway and see it. And I said, "Oh, Mary Kay, thanks for sharing that. I'm going to say that in worship tomorrow because I think that's so great." You know, God is working on this longer time horizon than us. See, our job isn't to add up all the, you know, the legacy pieces and to count it all. No, no, no. Our job is to do the investment with our heart, and God takes it from there. Believe you can make a difference because you believe in the difference maker. God doesn't waste what is given to him in faith. With me, when you add God to the equation, his output always exceeds your input. Thanks be to the one who made us and who guides us. Amen.